Since the early days of the space race, back in the 1950s and 60s, astronauts have undergone all sorts of regimes to prepare for the adverse effects of space travel and have been scrutinized for years after they've returned. For all the awe that space travel inspires, it does take a toll on human bodies. Abrupt changes of gravity, prolonged time in weightlessness, radiation exposure, and confinement itself threaten the well-being and sometimes even the mission of all astronauts. So what happens to the body in space? And how do astronauts adapt to life up there? Well, I thought we'd make a call to our good mate, David Renicky, astronomer and space historian, because I don't think I've ever stumped him on a question about space. David Renicky joins me this morning. Hello, David.
Good to be with you again, Brent. Thank you for that intro.
There's so many things to go through, and I want to start by saying this came about as a result of an article that I read in one of the papers, maybe a couple of months ago. I think it was the Sydney Morning Herald, and it was written about astronauts and the effects that space and space travel have on their bodies. I was absolutely fascinated with it, David.
Yeah.
Let's start with zero gravity. And it says that the first moments in space are the most impactful for human systems. And David, I didn't know, being a person that suffers from motion sickness myself all my life, 85% of astronauts experience some form of motion sickness apparently immediately.
Look, we didn't know these things happen. That's why the space station was built. We wanted to know, can we work safely, effectively, physically and psychologically in space there? And that's why they put that up there. And it's a working laboratory. And what we found out about it is exactly what you were talking about there. The amazing effects on the human body. We weren't meant to travel in space. We've been on this planet for its inception. We've grown up here. We've grown up on a planet with gravity on it. We can feel that. It's part of our lifestyle. When you move into space, you don't have that pull on your body. Everything's different. Significant changes happen to the physiology of the body there. These are prolonged weightlessness, periods of prolonged weightlessness and radiation exposure and confinement, the psychological side of it too, of things that they've really been probing up on the space station. We've learned a lot. We've learned to live and work in space, and we realise the damage it can do. Motion sickness, you mentioned, 85%, Brent, of astronauts suffer motion sickness when they come back home. That's nausea, headaches, and all sorts of inner ear and eye problems. Puffy head syndrome. Your body fluids move upwards when you're in space. Everything goes up, it doesn't go down. Look, gravity no longer pulls the fluid down. Cardiovascular problems. In space, you know, you lose about 1.5 litres of fluid, and that leads to changes in the shape of your heart because of the lack of gravitational pull there. The eyes suffer as well. 70% of astronauts have associated vision impairment there. The optic nerve swells up. Changes in the eye shape, they flatten. This is crazy stuff. We've learned to live with a lot of it. But there's still a lot to that. Bone and muscle degradation, this is a big one. We realise that you can lose bone density. 1% of bone mass per month you lose up on the space station. So an astronaut going up there at the age of 20 or 30, Brent, would come back after 2 years with the bone density of a 70 or 80-year-old. That's osteoporosis. So you can understand going through just what I did there. There's some of the major things, but there are a lot of little things too that they've got to get used to when they get home, and that's being at the kitchen table there. You know where I'm going with that one. What do astronauts forget most? Sitting at the table with their family after they come back, and that's not forgetting to let go of the coffee cup. Because in space, you can turn around, grab your pad and your pen, come back, and your cup's still sitting in front of you there. But certainly when you're at the table, bang, down it goes. Also, another thing too, your clothes feel like you've got wet clothes on. When you're in space there, you can't feel the sleeves on your body. You can't feel the trouser legs on your leg. And your skin becomes slightly smoother as well. It's just a condition that you're in. You're in an environment there that's different. When you come back here, you've got to get used to wearing clothes again. They tend to itch you. It's just like wearing a wet T-shirt or a wet pair of pants after you've been swimming. But there's some of the things that go wrong up there, so we weren't built for it.
David, let's talk about the flow of blood. And yes, the heart actually changes shape. And it changes shape and it becomes more like a sphere, doesn't it? So we think of the heart as, I suppose, a triangular shape. In space, the heart changes shape. It becomes like a sphere because of the lack of flow of blood to it.
Because you've got no pull of gravity pulling you down. Everything in your body is being pulled down to the ground. Everything, that's what gravity is. Gravity is holding you down here. It's a force that Newton knew about. And we through relativity, we know why it's there. It's bending of space-time that causes gravity. But when you're up in space there, you're not weightless. This is a wrong word, I think, a bad terminology. You're actually in free fall. You still weigh the same, but when you're in space, you're in free fall, so you're actually falling. That's why you feel it.
I think it was Chris Hadfield. For people that don't know, Chris Hadfield is the guy that you may have seen on the YouTube clip. He sang Space Oddity, the David Bowie song.
That was brilliant.
He said that being in space with zero gravity, what's it like on the body? He said, stand on your head for 12 hours and don't move. And that's what it does to your body. That's what you will feel like with zero gravity. And the other thing, David, that I found was fascinating is he said it never changes. You just get used to it. It's always uncomfortable. The feeling doesn't go away. You just get used to it.
You know, it's something that they go through this process. The only way that we can train anybody, there are actually two. The early way was the big pool, huge swimming pool that NASA have got there. And even with the shuttle there, they put a mock-up shuttle in there and they worked underwater to try and simulate the condition in space. But even that is only about one quarter of how it would feel. The other way is what's called the vomit comet. I don't know whether you've ever heard that.
I have. I was going to ask you, what is this vomit comet? Tell us what a vomit comet is.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly what it says, and it's a bit distasteful, but listen, look, it's a fact of life that what they do, they gut out a 747 or a larger aircraft, they gut the interior and they pad the wall, really, really heavily pad the wall, and they take you up to a certain height, and then the pilot puts the plane into a big dive. Now, for about 40 seconds, you're in this dive. You remember the, only a couple of weeks ago, it was a month or so back, the airplane flight where everybody hit the ceiling when it lost altitude?
Yes.
Yeah, same sort of thing. They were floating up just like you would there in the space station. That's why they were falling at their own weight, because that plane was dropping. But when you're in space there, that space station is continually dropping down towards the Earth. They've got to move it up a little bit higher every now and then, two or three times a year, to regain their altitude of about 380K. But the vomit comet there was made to simulate the weightless condition, the closest we can get to actually being in space. And it is very much like that. When they go up there, they have the astronauts in there to try and spin around, turn around, grab your pad, your pen, try and write. They simulate all the things that are going to happen up on the space station. It's only to get you used to it, because it's a hell of a shock when you get there and your hair's floating up in the air and, you know, you can leave your pen or your paper in front of you or your cup or whatever. But even Stephen Hawking, it was interesting, before he died, they took him up there and let him experience that. Now, this is a man who's had no motion, couldn't walk, and was completely, you know, all he could do was blink his eyes. He loved it. It was a great shot. I remember seeing that photograph of him up there spinning around in a weightless condition. And it might surprise you, too, that a lot of the movies that we've seen over the years, where you see them in a spaceship in the movie, floating around, a lot of those were done inside the vomit comet.
David, they talk about in this article exercise. It's a really important thing for astronauts to do, particularly astronauts that are in space for an extended period of time. How do they exercise, eat, and sleep in space?
Well, let me just go to the sleep one first. This is funny. I love talking about this one. They actually Velcro you to the side of the country. You can sleep standing up because there's no up or down in space. There's no up or down, nothing, left or right. It's all wherever you are. Wherever you are is up. Wherever you are is down. So you can actually, they actually Velcro you so you don't float away. But on the beds there, you're also tied down too. Well, that's fairly common. Going to the toilet's a bit of a different issue. When you go there, you sit down on the same sort of a loo you've got at home. There's not much difference to it. I sat on one at the Kennedy Space Center. You've got to be careful where you squat. And to help you out, there's a little camera in front of you on the wall that shows where you are at the backside. And all of a sudden, the pump starts up and all sucked into a tank. And that tank is exposed to the coldness and the the vacuum of space to kill all the bacteria. I think when they come back, they used to drop it into the atmosphere and burn it up on the shuttle. Zone density is a real worry. Over the years, they didn't know how to counter that. Now we've come up with drugs. Drugs are a one way of countering, but the best thing they've come up with is the old normal treadmill. And that's always been on the space station. It's always been used. They've got to go through a daily regime, a program, if you will, of exercise to keep the body supple. If you don't, your bones are just going to deteriorate, your muscles are going to become flabby, and it's just, this is why the space station's up there. You may remember the two twins, the Kelly twins, both the same age, both exactly the same twins. One went up into space, one was left behind here. And the one in space spent over a year around on the space station. When he came back, the doctors compared their physiology, and there was major changes too. The guy who was in space, and one of those was the flattening of the eyeball and other things too. So we're learning as we go. It's a whole new ball game. And can you imagine, you've got to get it right, because the journey to Mars in a weightless situation is going to be 7 months.
Talking about a journey to Mars, David, if someone wants to travel from Earth to Mars and back, the amount of radiation they are exposed to would mean they can no longer be exposed to any more radiation, according to their meter readings.
There is a limit to how much you can become exposed. Even pilots in aircraft that fly overseas, every, I think, two or three times a year, they've got to go through a check. They get more, two or three times more radiation than the ordinary citizen would. Even when you're travelling overseas in one of those planes, you are probably copping two or three chest x-rays worth there and then. But the radiation, look, we've got to be careful here, because it's not as bad as what it's made out to be. The capsules they're in, the space station itself, is heavily shielded. There's no issue with that. The radiation belts around the Earth are very weak. And that was one of the arguments with the people, they never went to the Moon Brigade. They would have been fried going through the radiation belts. The radiation belts, the Van Allen belts around the Earth, were only very weak. And when that happened there, James Van Allen came out in the early 60s when he heard that. And he said, no, he said, there's nothing there. He said, it's very, I found these. I spotted these. I'm the one who saw these first and named them. And he said, the radiation there is only very weak. But we do have suits now that protect us. When we go to Mars, we're going to have to wear them. Mars is going to be an issue. Radiation is one thing we've got to be careful of. The suits we wear will protect us. If you and I were on Mars, or anyone was on Mars now, there's two things we need to be aware of. The temperature there won't get much better than about -5. You know, a heat wave on Mars is about 7 or 8 degrees, and the winds there can get up to 200 or 300 km/h, but they're not strong winds. But if you remember the movie The Martian, the thing about that movie, the only incorrect thing about that, and that was the only movie ever made that was technically exact about what it would be like on Mars. The only thing is that the wind would not be as strong as what was shown in the movie. That was artistic effect. It was done well. But on Mars, the winds are only very thin. It's all carbon dioxide. And the winds on Mars are about as much as what you get just at the edge of the atmosphere there when you go up very, very high. If you open the door, if you wanted to be stupid, and open the door on an aircraft traveling between here and London, that's about the same temperature and about the same condition as the atmosphere you'd experience on Mars. So when we go to Mars, we've got to be careful that we're also not exposed to radiation, because Mars does not have a magnetic field anymore. Something happened to Mars a long time ago. We think at one stage it was very Earth-like, and there's evidence there was water, maybe lakes and oceans. But something hit Mars, something whacked into Mars a long time ago, Brent, and changed it forever, rocked it to its foundation. It lost its magnetic field, and when that happens, the atmosphere of any planet would drift away, leaving a carbon dioxide atmosphere. But more than that, when you lose your magnetic field, you also lose surface pressure. So all the water either would have evaporated or gone underground, and there's good evidence now of dry riverbeds on Mars. Mars is going to be a challenge, and the radiation you mentioned that started this part of the conversation is going to be one of our biggest issues.
All right, I'll let you go, but before I do, it's always fascinating when we speak to you about these things. I was just blown away that one of the details in this article says when a rocket lifts off, it reaches speeds of at least 7.9, let's round it out at 8 kilometres a second. Think about that for a moment. 8 kilometres a second to get it into orbit.
When you see the space station going over, remember that's moving at 28,000 km/h. Now they're looking down and they're moving at what you said, about 8K a second. This will go around the world once every 90 minutes in a corkscrew fashion. If it comes over the same face twice. What a job, Brent. What a job it is up there. Can you imagine? They've got a huge observation window, and they can see all the aurora on the Earth. They can see ships in the ocean as well. And that's what's a good meteorological station too. But they see 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets, Brent, every day.
Let me paint a picture. Andy Thomas, the Australian astronaut that travelled, I think he went to space three or four different times. He says he recalls being on a later mission and spacewalking outside the International Space Station. He said, I was at the top of the space station and mission control said, heads up, we're coming over Australia. And he said, I could see Australia pass beneath my feet 250 miles away. What an experience.
That'd be out of this world, wouldn't it? That'd be absolutely brilliant. And he wasn't our first Australian astronaut either, by the way. It was Paul Scully Power that went up a little bit before him.
I've got a quick question. Charlie says, he sent this in on email. He said, question for Dave Renicky, what happens to old and faulty satellites? Are they upsetting the magnetic balance? He says, are they polluting space? Could it be part of weather changes that we have down here?
Yeah, no. Yes and no. Look, yes, they are an issue. There are a lot up there. There's only about 7,000 satellites still in orbit around the Earth. Only 3,000 or 4,000 of those are still operable. In the old days, Brent, it wasn't a requirement to bring that satellite down. Now it is. If you launch something, you've got to have. The FAA will give you a certain orbit you can go to, and you've got to be able to deorbit that satellite if something goes wrong with it. In the early days, we didn't. Now, compounding that problem, you've got Elon Musk here, who wants to have a constellation of 40,000 satellites in orbit around the Earth. He's already got about 6,000 or so, and by the end of next year, I think you'll find that the heavens are going to be so crowded. Astronomers can't do astronomy anymore. They've really been down on Elon Musk about that. And I don't know, you would have heard, most people have now, that somebody's gone outside and saw this trail of lights moving across the sky. Not a week goes by, I don't get somebody saying, what is that? Well, that's the Starlink program that he's building, and it's an astounding sight to see these satellites moving across the sky. Do they have an effect on our weather? No, they can't. They're a long way from here. They're only tiny. They're not very big. So there's no concern, as far as I'm concerned, about that side of it, but certainly the pollution of the upper sky, the atmosphere we've got up there, is certainly got to be looked at. We're making a mess of the upper atmosphere like we did on our highways at one stage there, Bruce.
Very true. All right, David, I've taken up enough of your time. It's always a delight and a treat. And, we learn. We always learn every time we speak with you. So thanks for spending some of your Saturday morning with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Brent. Bye-bye.